The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. The court has four clauses on its oral submission docket this morning. In the order in which they will be presented, they are 990929, the Dow Chemical Company and Al against Larry Bright, Jr. from Brazoria County and the First Court of Appeals. 001325, Shanks against Treadway from Dallas County and the Fruit Court of Appeals. Consolidated for oral argument with Rice against Rice, 01251, from Harris County and the First Court of Appeals. And finally, 01535, Global Drywall Systems, Incorporated against Coronado Paint Company, Incorporated in KTA Tater, Inc., Cameron County, and the 13th Court of Appeals. In the first and last causes and the consolidated causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to argue. The petitioners may reserve time for rebuttal. The court will take a brief recess between each argument and finish the arguments before lunch. The arguments are being tape recorded for the court's convenience, and you may acquire a copy of the tape by request to the clerk and the payment of a nominal fee. The Chief Justice is absent because of family illness, but he is expected to participate in the deliberations and the decisions of all of these cases. The court would like to take note that John Adams, clerk of the court, is resigning, retiring in July the 5th, after a number of years of outstanding service, and we are grateful to him for that service and wish him well in every endeavor that he has after this. He can come back and help us out when we need it. The court is now ready to hear argument in the first case, Dow Chemical Company against Bright.
May it please the court, Mr. Joe Knight will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This is another case in which an injured worker who is barred by our workers' comp laws from suing his employer brings suit against the owner of the job site where he was injured. Now, the legal issue that's been briefed by the parties is whether the Dow Chemical Company owed a duty to Larry Bright. The more important policy consideration that must inform this analysis is whether Texas law is going to punish landowners or penalize landowners like Dow who take some steps to try to enhance worker safety without getting involved in any way in the operative details of the contractor negligence that causes the injury.
Mr. Knight, let me just ask you a question. The negligent sequencing claim of work, and I realize that your response is probably, well, that would swallow up everything because it's inherent in the landowner's duties to schedule work. But assume with me that, let me just ask it this way. Can there ever be such a thing as negligent sequencing on the part of the landowner?
I think there probably can, Your Honor. Putting aside for a moment the position advocated by Justice Hecht in his concurring opinion in Lee Lewis, which would say an employee in this circumstance could never bring a claim. Putting that aside, I think there could be. And I hope I have the chance to address the evidence of that in some detail, because the evidence doesn't come close to supporting the allegations of the brief.
Okay, but if the landowner can negligently sequence the work, I would like for you to tell me I guess you'd have to prove as a matter of law there's no evidence of that. You'd have to disprove that.
Here's the way I would... I think you're right, Your Honor, and here's the way I would say it. I would readily concede this would be a much different case if there were evidence that Gulf States came to Dow and said, all right, here's our plan. We're going to send Mr. Bright out there this morning to remove the forms from the concrete that we poured. And then after that, we're going to send the pipe crew in and put the pipe up above. And Dow said, no, 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 I don't want you to do that. I insist that you first put the pipe up there and then send Mr. Bright in. If there were evidence like that, I think this case would fall in the category of cases where the landowner has basically given the command that has caused the injury.
Well, even absent that specific situation, what if they just had the two crews coming to do the work at the same time without any real discussion of it? Could that ever be negligence in and of itself?
I think if it was the landowner's decision to do that, then that falls into the category of cases this court has recognized give rise to a duty where the landowner is essentially giving the instruction or giving the command that is the cause of the injury.
Okay, so with that said, was this a no-evidence summary judgment motion?
No.
Traditional?
It was a traditional motion.
Okay. Can you tell me, was that conclusively negated or was that brought up? That is a piece that has been raised here.
Right. Well, if you trace the history of this case, what you'll find is there was about a one-sentence throwaway remark in the response to the motion for summary judgment that said, Dow retained the authority over scheduling of the work. And it wasn't particularly argued. And it wasn't particularly argued in the court of appeals. All the focus was on the fact that Dow had a guy out there who had the authority to stop work if he actually observed a safety violation. After the court of appeals decision, this court decided to coach that, which really, I think, entirely undermines the basis of the Court of Appeals decision. And then the focus shifted to this notion of negligent scheduling. And here's, I'll go ahead and address now the evidence of that point, because I think it's quite remarkable. I mean, here's a quote from Bright's brief. Dow actively scheduled job site activities so as to increase the likelihood of injury to Bright. That's on page 3. Of the respondent's brief. And there's some dozen or more times where a statement essentially like that appears in the brief. And when, just as Your Honor obviously is on, when you read that, you say, well, that sounds like a pretty solid basis for imposing a duty. I mean, I wonder why the Court of Appeals didn't base its decision on that. And the answer is there's not a shred of evidence to support that. What we have, the evidence submitted by Dow in support of its motion conclusively negated that. Included three affidavits from Gulf States employees. Mr. Bright's direct supervisor, the overall superintendent on the job, and the field safety representative. And all three of them collectively testified that Dow didn't control any of the details of these activities. That all of the choices, unequivocal, all of the choices and decisions regarding the installation of the pipe and the removal of concrete forms were made by Gulf States, not by Dow. And in response to that, in support of this notion that Dow actively scheduled job site activities, here's the evidence cited by Brock. First, the contract itself has a section in it called time for completion. What that says is the work shall be commenced and completed according to a schedule agreed upon by Dow and the contractor. Commenced and completed. That's all it says. It doesn't say anything about the detailed sequencing of the thousands of individual tasks that would go into constructing an off-gas compressor that we have at issue here. Then we had the testimony of Mr. Dodson, which is in the summary judgment record. He is Dow's, he was Dow's on-site representative. And he was asked questions by Mr. Bright's counsel and said, did you have input into the schedule? And what he explained was, the contractor has to provide a schedule that he can use to monitor the progress on the job. And he was asked, well, can you change that? And he said, well, yeah, if they propose a schedule that won't allow them to complete their job on time, because I got to go get the next contract going, then I can submit a change order. Again, no testimony relating the top side or bottom to the details of sequencing individual tasks. It had to do with completion of the project pursuant to this provision of the contract. So all they are left with, and this is what they rely most heavily on, is the deposition testimony of a guy named William Ray Knock. He's a disgruntled former employee, had just recently been fired. And it's important to note that He never worked on this contract. Never worked on this particular contract at all. Now, counsel for Bright put the contract in front of him and pointed to this section that I talked about where the Dow and the contractor are supposed to agree on a schedule for completion and said, why is that in here? And he said, I have to make assumptions. I couldn't tell you why that's in here because he wasn't part of the contract. And so then the question was, well, tell me, Mr. Rednaga, why would you want to have some voice in the scheduling of jobs? And that's where they get the testimony. Rednaga says, I would want to have a voice in that because I would want to know if I've got two crews out there working at the same time where they might create hazards for each other. He did not testify, and he couldn't have because he wasn't involved, that happened in this case. He did not testify that Dow had that authority pursuant to this contract because he wasn't involved in it. So what we really have as far as evidence in the record on this issue is simply that the contract said they're supposed to get together and agree on a schedule for commencement and completion. There's not a shred of evidence in the record that Dow ever scheduled individual job tasks.
Instead of no evidence in the record, under traditional summary judgment motion, how did you negate that?
We negated it by putting in evidence that said it was Gulf States who controlled every detail of the activity. Here I can give you the...
But they didn't control the schedule.
They did control the schedule.
And there's summary judgment proof of that.
Yes, so that was what Mr. Dobson testified to, that they come in and bring the schedule. And he is supposed to look at it to see if it allows them to complete it on time. Now there's no evidence, I'll put it this way, there's no evidence in the record of what the schedule was regarding individual sequencing of individual tasks. I don't think we've got evidence specifically addressing that point. What we do have is evidence that says that all of these workers were under the control and supervision of Gulf States, not Dow.
Well, I understand that concept, and I guess what I'm focusing on is controlling the details of the events. If it's the landowner saying, I'm going to put carpenters out there underneath pipe fitters at the same time, the allegation seems to be that in and of itself is some evidence that there was negligent scheduling. And that even though Gulf decided to come in and be there when the landowner told him to, that just by scheduling someone to be working over them, that's some evidence of negligence.
But that didn't happen. I guess here's the way I look at it, and maybe I'm missing a point of procedure. The evidence that Dow attached to its motion established that Gulf States controlled every aspect of this off-gas compressor unit from top to bottom, beginning to end. I think that gives Dow, if they hadn't filed any kind of response, that would give Dow summary judgment. They come along and file a response that has a line in it that says Dow controlled the scheduling, but they put no evidence. They put nothing in the record that would raise a fact issue on that question. There's no issue of material fact for a jury to decide out of this record whether Dow controlled the schedule. It's just not in there.
Yeah, it just seems like I could easily see that under no evidence motion, but it seems like if that theory is raised, it would be your burden to prove that you did not control the sequence.
I think what we have to have is enough evidence that if they don't affirmatively raise a fact issue, like I said, if they didn't respond at all, is our evidence sufficient to give us summary judgment? Think it is. And if it is, then wouldn't they have to identify evidence in the record that raises a fact issue?
I'm sure they're going to have a lot to say on
that. All right. This is, I know the court has written on this issue.
Now, you, from your argument, you're saying that our decision in Lee Lewis is clear that if there is to be liability on the contractor's part, the particular event that occurred, they must have had control over the safety aspect of that particular event. And you think Lee Lewis clearly establishes that as the proposition or not?
I don't think that's exactly how Lee Lewis puts it. The way I read Lee Lewis, and if I can back up and answer just slightly more globally, if you look at all of this court's decisions in this area, there's only two situations where this court has ever approved of a landowner owing a duty of reasonable care. And that is, one, where the landowner made the specific decision, gave the specific instruction that caused the injury, and two, where the landowner retained the authority to stop unsafe work practices on its premises, actually witnessed safety violations and realized the peril and chose to keep quiet instead of exercising that authority. Thankfully, Lewis fits more into that second category. And in fact, every one of the justices' opinions in that case recites evidence and says it's fair to hold Lewis to a duty here because they actually knew these contractors' employees were out there in violation of their own safety requirements. They actually enforced that requirement to their own employees, and they took, even though they had the authority and responsibility to stop unsafe practices that they were aware of, they chose to disregard it.
Well, then taking your view of Lee Lewis, tell me why here where Dow Chemical had the authority to stop work on the premises, the allegation is made that the supervisor was there and saw the pipe hung that way, and that should have put the employer on the Dow on notice that that was a dangerous way of hanging that pipe, and Dow remained silent when they could have done something about it. How does that not fit Lee Lewis, as you just now described Lee Lewis means to you?
Because the middle step of what Your Honor just said is missing from this case. That is, there is no evidence. I don't even think there's an allegation that Dow's owner representative realized there was danger out there. There's no allegation that there was anything obvious about the way this pipe was that made it, that he recognized it was installed improperly. In fact, all the evidence is that nobody realized that. And I think if they had evidence that he saw it and said, geez, that's a dangerous situation, and didn't say anything about it, that would bring it into Lee Lewis' side of the camp.
I didn't understand. Are you saying he didn't see it, or he saw it but didn't realize it was dangerous?
Well, I mean, he saw the pipe, but did not. I mean, this is a huge pipe. Now, on a huge project. And so, I mean, nobody, you could drive by on the highway and see the pipe. He did not see that it was not secured properly.
What you're saying
so it's
is
not just that he didn't realize the method of securing was inadequate. He did not see.
In your summary judgment, you're not the control issue, but your summary judgment motion specifically attacks whether or not Dow saw the pipe hung improperly.
Yes. Yes. There's testimony from Mr. Dodson that said he just had no idea. If he had seen it, in fact, this is exactly how he put it. If I had seen it, and if I had realized it was a safety problem, then sure, I would have done something about it.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counselor. Court's ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
May it please the Court, Mr. James Lewis will present arguments.
May it please the Court. What counsel is really arguing is the difference between gross negligence and ordinary negligence. He's saying that you have to have actual knowledge of the hazard before you ever even get to a jury. He's saying that despite the testimony of Mr. Sambira and Mr. Renaga, that Mr. Dodson's 15-step inspection and testing process, which he was obligated to do under Dow's own self-imposed exclusive permit issuing, that is, safe work permit issuing procedure, should have uncovered that hazard. Dow's own safety representatives admit that it should have uncovered that hazard, he should have recognized it, and then he could have changed it. He could have not issued that permit until they had properly secured the pipe. They have an obligation, a self-imposed obligation, to conduct a 15-step inspection and testing process, and then they review the potential hazards with the subcontractors. The very purpose of that is to reveal and recognize hazards such as this.
The argument is made that if you can be liable for failing to follow that 15-step or however many step process it is, that the incentive is for the contractor not to have such a process, which lessens safety on the job. What's the response to that?
The policy consideration is whether we're going to hold owners responsible for the consequences of violating their own self-imposed duties.
What I'm asking you is, if that incentive is, well, I'm the owner, I just won't have. I won't worry about safety. Won't more people be hurt that way?
No, because then it would be delegated to someone else. You've heard the saying that everyone's responsibility is no one's responsibility. If that was specifically set forth and delegated that y'all are going to conduct your own inspection and testing process subcontracted, you are the ones who are going to determine whether there are any hazards that need to be corrected out there, then Gulf States would undertake that policy. And Gulf States had its own safety representative there, but it was an exclusive right of Dow to issue the safe work permit.
But Gulf States was a non-subscriber. Are you saying here that they would have had no liability and all liability would have been imposed on Dow?
No, I believe there would be a joint liability. I mean, I believe Gulf States certainly still has the a responsibility for a safe place of employment. But certainly Dow would also have responsibility because it undertook a 15-step inspection and testing process that their own representatives testified should have revealed the hazard involved here, the specific hazard of the unsecured pipe. And if there's any doubt as to whether Dow actually had control to correct the situation, it was resolved by their own approval of a policy of rigging the pipe that actually would have prevented this accident, as Mr. Stano testified.
With regard to that point, as I understand the evidence, that policy was post-accident. What's your response to that?
It is actually not clear in the record whether it's post or pre-accident, but I'm not disputing whether or not it was. I'm just saying that certainly whether it was post-accident or pre-accident, it certainly shows their right of control. But that goes more to the retained control argument, that is, retained right of control argument, than the active control, the actual exercise
of control. How does that fit in with the hypothetical right of control? We've held that there won't be any liability for a hypothetical. Isn't that a hypothetical right to control as opposed to an actual exercise?
It's obviously an actual right of control since they did it. Whether before or after the accident, they in fact exercised control and approved a method of securing the pipe that would have prevented the accident. I mean, certainly they would concede from now on, whether it's after the accident or not, after they proposed that standard which would have prevented the accident, certainly they're going to have responsibility for a similar accident now because they've exercised control. But even if they had not done it until after the accident, and the record is not real clear on that, certainly they didn't just gain the right to approve that standard after the accident. Dow had control, had a contract which required adherence to all of their safety manuals, which had step-by-step procedures in them about how Gulf States was to perform its work. I also would like to speak to the sequencing issue, because that is critically important. Dow, at page 342, it's the evidence is that Dow was actually involved in the sequencing. And very important, in the contract itself, section 4.01, they required that Gulf States perform the work with utmost speed. Combine the fact that they require Gulf States to perform the work with utmost speed with the fact that they approved the pipe fitters to work directly over the head of the carpenters. The contract did require approval by Dow of the scheduling and the process. And there wasn't any doubt as to whether they had control over that. The precise testimony of Mr. Dodson was the question, did Dow have the right to control how that schedule worked? Answer, yes, yes. If they wanted the work to be done in a different ordering, could they change it? Answer, with the change order, yes. That's at page 156. There's no doubt that they had control over the scheduling, and they required it to be conducted with utmost speed, that is the work of Gulf States, and approved a schedule whereby pipe fitters worked directly over the head of Bright. Certainly, that is enough evidence to get to a jury. Considering the evidence in a light most favorable to the non-movement here, Bright, and indulging all reasonable inferences in his favor, this court should affirm the Court of Appeals decision.
What creates some concern for me is just for some reason this court and the legislature have just been very reluctant to just assign responsibility for safety to the general contractor or the landowner when they've got other people coming out there working on the job site. And even if there's been kind of a safety inspector there on the on the ground, and they've hesitated to do that. And even in light of the fact that an owner could always tell a contractor to get off the property, or a contractor could always tell a subcontractor to get off the property. I mean, they're the boss. They virtually control everything, even if they say they don't control everything, because they, in fact, make the final decision. Even the scheduling, it seems to me Dow Chemical can argue we had nothing to do with the scheduling, but of course they did. They're the boss. They could tell them, I don't want you to do that, or you can do that. And then the parties can say, well, that's a breach of contract, or walk away. But there any question that when Dow Chemical says, this is what we want to do, the other side's going to have to respond in some manner. But it seems to me that the court still is reluctant to assign tort liability for these general types of interests and responsibility there. And I don't see how the facts in this case can be parsed so thinly that the jurisprudence remains with a dichotomy on the right to control or the exercise of control and just the general authority of the boss to make these decisions. I don't see how you can parse the line so finely as you're saying we can in this case without basically saying a general contractor, you're just going to be responsible, or owner, you're just going to be responsible for injuries on the job site because it necessarily is a result of it not being safe. How can we parse it so finely based on what you say without, in effect, saying all generals are going to be liable?
The difference is, Your Honor, is that it isn't assigning responsibility. It is the responsibility that Dow actually accepted. They took on the responsibility for the 15-step inspection and testing process.
Whether they actually took it on or not, whether they took on the 15-step deal or whether they just had them walking the field and they should have known this was a dangerous way for the pipe to do it, I don't see how that makes a difference.
The difference is the actual exercise of control and the nexus between the actual exercise of control and the injury.
Well, let's talk about the nexus. Where's the nexus on the 15-step process and this pipe fitting erection? Where is that nexus in the record?
Mr. Renaga and Mr. Sambira both testified that Mr. Godson, under the identical facts, a hypothetical was posed and then the hypothetical was proved up in the testimony. At pages 334 through 343 in the record and pages 379 through 395, especially 379 to 382 and page 334 to 36 and 343 are the main pages where they indicate that he should have recognized the hazard and he had authority to stop work or to otherwise make orders to correct the hazard.
Okay,
that is, in the inspection, it should have been recognized by Dodson and he actually had a responsibility. There is testimony that he actually had a responsibility to inspect the manner of the rigging of the pipe at page 343. So the idea that he has a responsibility to inspect and then review the potential hazards with the subcontractor by their own self-imposed duty certainly is a nexus between the failure to correct that hazard or potential hazard and the injury.
How do we square that with Lee Lewis, though? Because in Lee Lewis, we faulted the premises owner there for specifically failing to stop that hazardous chair use process.
The sole difference between this and Lee Lewis is they had a full-blown trial, and they actually had evidence that Lee Lewis reviewed and recognized the hazard but approved it anyway. Here, you've got one of three things. I mean, if this court is going to indulge all inferences in favor of the non-movement, you could infer that Mr. Dodson, in fact, did see the potential hazard, recognized it as a hazard, and did nothing about it, issued a safe work permit anyway. That's a reasonable inference that should defeat summary judgment in itself.
What evidence would we infer that?
On the evidence from Mr. Sambira and Mr. Renaga that if he conducted an appropriate inspection, that he would have recognized the hazard, he would have seen it, and that he actually had a responsibility for inspecting the manner of rigging.
But there isn't any evidence that actually happened.
There isn't evidence that he recognized the hazard. That is, he didn't come out and admit, yeah, I recognize the hazard. I saw that improperly secured pipe. But when would you ever get that?
Well, in Lee Lewis, it wasn't that survived. I can't remember if the supervisor testified to that, but there were other people standing around that said, you know, we were standing right there and looked at it.
Well,
and, of course, in Lee Lewis, people were standing on the ground looking up there, seeing a guy hang off the building.
Well, as counsel just conceded, it's a huge pipe. If you look at it at all, you can certainly see the manner in which it's secure. And here, if he had an actual responsibility, which Mr. Sambira and Mr. Renata said he did, to inspect the manner of securing the pipe, and he didn't recognize it as a hazard, are we going to excuse Dow because they had such an inexperienced or incompetent inspector that he didn't recognize the hazard when he saw it? And that is exactly the point of the illustrations that I provided. The first illustration provides those potential situations. Another one is that he never conducted the inspection at all, so he never saw it, in which case he would be violating his own responsibility for conducting the inspection, testing, and review process. And that is the policy consideration for this.
Let me ask you about a policy consideration. Let's say that we hold as you want us to in this case, and we affirm and you have the trial. What does that tell general contractors? And I heard you answer a few moments ago that, well, if the general contractor doesn't have the responsibility, the subcontractor will, and you sort of diffuse that responsibility. Wouldn't that recommend to the general to pull away and let's not have these safety inspections, and let's not have somebody that's, overall responsible for the overall safety when you have 50 different subcontractors coming in? Let each of the subcontractors do that themselves. Doesn't that, in the end, increase the danger if you don't have somebody that has an overall view of the scene in terms of safety? Doesn't that enhance the dangers to all of the employees of individual contractors on the site?
Certainly not as much as a holding that would say, general contractors and owners, you are not responsible for the consequences of the actions you undertake. If this court rules that they are not responsible for failing to properly perform their inspection and testing process, which they undertake, and failing to properly supervise the job sequencing, which they undertake, and there is a nexus between that and the injury, but they say that you still don't have any responsibility for those consequences, that will certainly make work sites everywhere much more hazardous.
Well, in just about every case that's tried in these circumstances, the general is going to get up on the stand and say, because he'd be a fool not to, that yes, I have the power to stop unsafe activities, and yes, I can kick them off the scene, and yes, if I see something dangerous happening, I'm going to respond. I have that measure of control. And if we're to hold here that what Dow has done, just in terms of having, some responsibility over safety, that makes them potentially liable, then our whole tort system in this area is going to change, it seems to me.
Well, no, we aren't talking about just a general responsibility or ability to start and stop work.
Well, you're talking about the safety manuals, right? That's one of the pegs of your argument, that they have control because they have they require subcontractors to comply with safety generally.
Yes, they require contractors as an integral part of the contract to adhere to step-by-step safety manuals. But
if that's all that you had in this case, would there be a fact issue that would entitle you to a jury trial?
It depends on the nexus between what was in the safety manuals. That is, what the adherence.
Well, what is that nexus here? I mean, in this case, if that's all you had, would there be a fact issue?
Yes, because in this case, the obligation imposed upon them within one of those manuals that is imposed upon Dow is to conduct the 15-step process of testing and inspection and review of the hazards, which, according to their own testimony, would have revealed the hazard of the unsecured pipe. And therefore, they then had a responsibility, having seen the hazard, if they had appropriately conducted the inspection, to take some measures to eliminate it or not issue the daily safe work permit.
Which would
remember,
mean
that's an exclusive right that belongs to them.
But that would mean that to the extent there are safety manuals that have inspection steps, in the state of Texas, then the general contractor will be liable for any injury to a subcontractor's employee?
No, it depends on what inspections they say and what evidence there is of the nexus between the inspection and the injury. Here there was direct evidence from Mr. Renaga and Mr. Sambira that hazard should have been uncovered had the inspection been undertaken. So you have a strong nexus there. They also testified that the sequencing of the job and the approval of the sequencing of the pipe fitters working over the heads of the carpenters increased the likelihood of injury to those working below.
Well, let me make sure I understand the evidence on that, on the sequencing. My understanding is Mr. Bright is a carpenter, and he's an employee of Gulf States, and the pipe fitter was also an employee of that same subcontractor. That's correct. Right? They're
yes,
both working for Gulf States.
The pipe fitters and the carpenters are both working for Gulf States.
Where is the evidence that, in this case, for this accident, Dow directed the pipe fitter to commence work before Mr. Bright?
There actually is not evidence that says Dow said, okay, now pipe fitters, you go work up there at the same time as the carpenters. There's only evidence that they required the work to be done with utmost speed and that they, in fact, did have the right to control how that schedule worked. And that was unequivocal evidence that they had the right to control how it worked and they could change it with a simple change order if they saw any potentially hazardous condition. And it ties in with the 15-step process of inspection that certainly if you see pipe fitters working over the head of carpenters, that is another thing that if you were going to issue a daily safe work permit, it probably shouldn't be issued until that is corrected, and certainly not until you correct the situation of the unsecured pipe. Considering the evidence in a light most favorable to Bright, that certainly is sufficient evidence to get to a jury on this issue. And the Court of Appeals did not impose any duty at all on Dow. The Court of Appeals simply held that there was a question of material fact regarding the level of control exercised by Dow such that it would give rise to a duty. I believe the evidence is stronger than that. I believe that the evidence that we have put forth actually establishes a duty on behalf of Dow to Bright. However, we request that this court affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals, and we further request that this court issue appropriate instructions that, in fact, a duty exists for the benefit of workers at all construction sites to hold the owners and general contractors responsible for the actions which they undertake at their own options. And if there are no further questions.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Knight, what if the premises owner says to the subcontractor, I will inspect this premises before you begin work every day and make sure they're safe before you come to work? And that's the agreement between the parties. And they just simply don't do that. Is there any liability there?
I could conceive of a fact pattern where, depending on where the contract allocated responsibility for safety and what the evidence...
But assume the contract says that the landowner says to the contract, I will look at the premises to make sure they're safe, and I won't let you start work until I've inspected the premises. And what if they just simply did not do that? What if the sub shows up, the landowner's not there, never does what he agreed to do, what then?
I'll answer it in two parts. One, I don't think that scenario has ever arose, and I don't think there's any authority that would inform us. Two, I would think that consistent with the court finding it's reasonable to impose a duty in circumstances where you actually know of the hazard and don't do anything about it, it's probably fair and reasonable to impose a duty.
I'm not talking about actual knowledge.
I know you're not. I'm saying consistent with that line of thought, I think it's fair and reasonable to say in a circumstance where you promised to do something and the contract required you to do it and didn't allocate it to somebody else and your failure to do that caused the harm or prevented the harm from being discovered, I could see the court imposing as a matter of policy liability in that circumstance.
Okay,
yes.
Okay. So if you have an agreement that I will inspect to make sure the premises is safe before you begin work, and you don't show up at all and don't do that at all, then you're saying there could be liability in that situation.
I could conceive of that.
And yeah. What's the difference between that and you do an inspection, but it's a sloppy inspection, and you don't discover something that should have been discovered? What's the difference there?
The difference is that in this instance, the contract specifically allocated responsibility for workplace safety to Gulf States. And the evidence submitted in support of Dow's motion for summary judgment from every Gulf States employee involved said safety was our responsibility.
And if that's the case, then why did they have a policy to go in and do a 15-step process?
Because Dow is going above and beyond the call. This is the policy issue that I began with. In this case, there's no question under the contract that the responsibility was Gulf States. But Dow did have policies in place to try to enhance worker safety.
It seems that, I mean, following up on what Justice Hecht asked earlier, that we do want, it would be good to encourage general contractors to make workplaces more safe. But the point is that if they do decide to accept responsibility and exercise a duty, then others on the workplace rely upon it.
No evidence, Your Honor, of reliance.
No, I'm talking about from a policy matter in terms of how we deal with this circumstance on construction work sites. And we know we know that there are significant issues relating to safe workplace that have significant policy issues behind them. The point being that the reason why the law recognizes responsibility if someone assumes a duty is because then people expect that duty to be performed properly.
I don't think that notion has had any place in Restatement 414 or in this court's precedent.
Why isn't that the policy that underlines 414, that if you either retain the control contractually or actually exercise control, then that gives rise to the duty? But that supports good policy in tort law as well as good public policy, that once that duty has been assumed, it must be exercised with reasonable care.
Two reasons. Because on the facts of this case, that duty is entirely redundant. It's entirely above and beyond the call because the contract says Gulf States is responsible for safety. But more specifically on 414, comment C specifically says that you don't incur a duty under this section by retaining the right to inspect and by retaining the right to stop work if you see something.
No, sir, and I'm not talking about the specifics. I'm not talking about whether it's a duty to inspect or whatever with given the parameters on 414. I'm just talking about a duty that would be recognized under 414. It seems to me that the policy that underlies it is that if the duty has been assumed, it must be exercised reasonably because it is something that is then recognized as existing within that workplace.
Well, I would think, Your Honor, it depends on the duty. I mean, if the contract said Dow will provide safe crane to lift the pipe, and Dow provided an unsafe crane, surely I can see liability in that situation. But we're not talking about that.
Okay, and then let's look at that scenario, and then it's good public policy to recognize liability under those circumstances.
Well, I mean, putting aside the
argument. Yes, no.
Well, I think not because of the issue of why would a worker who is injured on his own employer's premises have more rights than somebody doing the same thing on somebody else's.
But aside from that, yes. From the standpoint of tort law, that if, in fact, they affirmatively take on the responsibility to make sure that the crane operates safely and properly so that the subcontractor relies on them to do it, the workers rely on that to do it, isn't it good public policy for them to be required to exercise that care reasonably and be responsible for
it? Sure. Okay. But the restatement makes it clear that the right to inspect is different from that.
I'm not talking about the right to inspect. I'm just talking generally in terms of public policy. Okay. The concern that's been expressed about the fact that if we impose responsibility on general contractors and they just won't do anything on a work site. And it seems to me the countervailing argument to that is that once they choose to take on the duty and actually exercise control, then they create a circumstance on the workplace where others have relied upon it. And others perhaps would pick up that responsibility if, in fact, they hadn't undertaken it.
Well, I do think, Your Honor, if I might, that there is a very distinct difference between undertaking responsibility in the contract. Everybody out there knows, all right, you got to do this, landowner's got to do this, versus you got to do it, but because we want to go above and beyond, we're going to come along behind you and do some extra inspection. I think there's a big difference between those two.
Mr. Knight, let me ask you just a couple questions. I know the time's up, but it's a question that bothers me. It seems to me as this court developed its discussion about who's going to be liable for injuries that occur in the workplace,
and has to do if you retain control or exercise control over the activity that produced the injury, there's some liability there. It seemed to me that probably was a very workable solution when historically you'd hire a subcontractor to go replace the glazing in a building and you walked away because you know nothing about putting glazing. But now OSHA, it seems to me, comes in and requires contractors to be in charge of safety. It's not exactly, it seems to me, as Dow would like it to be, where they're just free to choose whether to impose safety requirements or not. OSHA probably puts some sort of duty on Dow Chemical to assure the safety of its premises for these people that come there. So I'm wondering if there isn't the whole argument about the safety mechanism that's being talked about as where I voluntarily undertake it or not really works in our old system of things. I wonder, is Dow really under some obligations statutorily or governmentally to oversee safety on their premises when they've got subcontractors working on their premises?
Your Honor, I candidly don't know if Dow retains that responsibility under federal law if it assigns it via the contract to its subcontractor. I thought the law was still that I could sign a contract with my subcontractor that gives them total control over all aspects of the job, including safety, and then I can go on vacation and say, call me when you're done.
But you chose not to.
Right, and that's the policy here. We have still allocated the safety responsibility to Gulf States, and Gulf States has stepped up to the plate in the summary judgment evidence and said we accept it. Dow's come along and gone above and beyond. Same as the employer in the Mendez case, same as the employer in the Cope versus Chapa case, has come along and done inspections to try to enhance worker safety, and in the Court of Appeals decision, by merely doing that, has incurred a duty that didn't otherwise have.
If I understand correctly, now you're saying you really don't know whether or not the federal government is in fact requiring Dow to do the things that it's doing.
I don't know the answer.
Okay, whether this is purely gratuitous on Dow's part.
I don't know the answer.
One thought, but what
premises when they've got subcontractors working on their premises?
Your Honor, I candidly don't know if Dow retains that responsibility under federal law if it assigns it via the contract to its subcontractor. I thought the law was still that I could sign a contract with my subcontractor that gives them total control over all aspects of the job, including safety, and then I can go on vacation and say, call me when you're done.
But you've chosen not to.
Right, and that's the policy here. We have still allocated the safety responsibility to Gulf States, and Gulf States has stepped up to the plate in the summary judgment evidence and said we accept it. Dow's come along and gone above and beyond. Same as the employer in the Mendez case, same as the employer in the Cope versus Chapa case, has come along and done inspections to try to enhance worker safety, and under the Court of Appeals decision, by merely doing that, has incurred a duty that didn't otherwise have.
If I understand correctly, now you're saying you really don't know whether or not the federal government is in fact requiring Dow to do the things that it's doing.
I don't know the answer.
Okay, I mean, whether this is purely gratuitous on Dow's part.
I don't know the answer.
One thought, but what you just said, over and above is Dow's 15-step procedure, and they come along and do it, but they do it negligently. Isn't Dow liable because they have negligently performed a procedure that they assume to do?
No, Your Honor, because again, that's the restatement that says you don't assume the duty by retaining the right to inspect. That would be a hollow limitation if it said, yeah, but if you inspect negligently, you do retain the duty. I think the line has got to be on actual knowledge, and that's the Koch case. I mean, Koch had a safety guy out there, and there was evidence in the.
Well, Koch. I understand when you then start to say actual knowledge, that adds another fact to the mix. But the assumption is that they've got a policy that, if properly done, would uncover these things and they would have knowledge, doesn't it?
That's exactly the argument. That's exactly the argument.
But you say that's not a good argument.
No, it's certainly not. And if I could do this last point, because it's responsive and it wraps it all up. When this line of cases began back in 1976, that was precisely the view of the dissenting justices. In the Abelos case, 1976, Justice Reedley said the law ought to be that if the landowner knows or should know of the danger on his site, he's got a duty to warn about it or require the work to stop. And Justice Reedley only got two votes for that back in 1976. That has never been the law in Texas, and it shouldn't be the law today.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument for the first case, and the court will take a brief recess.